Welcome. Good evening. Warm summer evening. Another Dharma talk. I think it's nice to question why we come to Dharma talks. Some of us are new to it, so we're curious. Some come again and again, maybe out of obligation. Keep the Zen wheel rolling. Some maybe for spiritual community, to be around like-minded people. Maybe we have some ideas about Zen practice, and we may come to a Dharma talk to make sure that they are confirmed. Or maybe just the opposite. Maybe we feel like we come actually to hear something fresh and new that we've never heard before. I always appreciate when the talk comes out like that to my ears. So it's good to, I think, ask ourselves anytime we come, yeah, what is it about? Especially like the long-termers who just come again and again. So in this appreciation of something fresh and new, a new perspective, I've been recently reading some of the words of the doctor and physicist Robert Lanza. Has anybody heard of Robert Lanza? I hadn't heard of him before coming across his book called Biocentrism. But apparently in 2014, he was one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Some say he's the most important doctor in the world, partly because he was one of the originators of like stem cell research, so like really cutting edge biotechnology, as well as physics. He seems to hang out with like quantum physicists and that whole realm too. Seems like an interesting character, but he's got this book called Biocentrism, a new theory of the universe, looking at how the universe came to be, which is a lot of cutting-edge scientists are trying to discover. So here's some of the things he says. We need a revolution in our understanding of science and of the world. Living in an age dominated by science, we have come more and more to believe in an objective, empirical reality and in the goal of reaching a complete understanding of that reality. And he talks about how scientists are trying to come up with the theory of everything that explains like the universe. These big overarching theories. And he says, but these big overarching theories of everything are really fooling ourselves. He says, most of these comprehensive theories are no more than stories that fail to take into account one crucial factor, that we are creating them. It is the biological creature that makes observations, names what it observes, and creates stories. science has not succeeded in confronting the element of existence that is at once most familiar and most mysterious, conscious experience. Some scientists look into that, and it seems that quantum physics, that newest form of physics, whether they like it or not, it seems to be that this element of conscious experience is creeping into these discoveries, you know, that the observer affects the outcome of experiments and so on. Then Lanza here quotes Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson from the 19th century, has an essay called Experience. And he says, in those old days, we have learned that we do not see directly, but mediately. So I think that's a word that I never heard before, but it sounds like the opposite of immediately. Yeah, seeing immediately or directly would be without mediation, without something in between. Yeah. But Emerson says, we have learned that we do not see directly, but mediately. And that we have no means of correcting these colored and distorting lenses We have no means of correcting these colored and distorting lenses which we are, or of computing the amount of their errors. Yeah. Perhaps these subject-lenses, in other words, we as the subject are the lens, perhaps these subject lenses have a creative power. Perhaps there are no objects. Emerson says that we as the observer maybe have a kind of creative power, and that maybe he's crazy to go so far as to say perhaps there are no objects outside of our subject lenses that can never really see an object directly. So then this theory of biocentrism of Robert Lanza, one point about it is as you can maybe get the gist from the word biocentrism that I think he probably made up, it's a theory that the universe is biocentric, meaning like it originates from life, as opposed to the usual story, like maybe Darwin's story, is there was a universe of rock and gases and elements for billions of years, and then at some point the conditions were just right, and something called life emerged on this planet, and life became conscious of the world. So that's a kind of maybe we'd say mineral-centric universe, but biocentric universe is more that first there was conscious life before there was a universe, and that life or consciousness actually gave rise to so-called physical universe that maybe isn't really such a external material object as science is trying to figure out what it's made of. So he says that part of this theory is to explain this unusual situation we have of this particular world and life on this earth. So Lanza says, modern science cannot explain why the laws of physics are exactly balanced for animal life to exist. For example, if the Big Bang had been one part in a billion more powerful, it would have rushed out too fast for the galaxies to form and for life to begin, according to the studies. If the strong nuclear force were decreased by 2%, atomic nuclei wouldn't hold together. Hydrogen would be the only atom in the universe. So it's this very delicate balance we're in, right? Universally and on the planet Earth. if the gravitational force were decreased even a little bit, the stars, including the sun, would not ignite. These are just three of more than 200 physical parameters within the solar system and universe, so exact that they cannot be random. Or scientists are saying, it's such an amazing coincidence, incredible coincidence, that all these 200 factors came out just exactly right for what we call life to emerge. And indeed, Lanza says, the lack of a scientific explanation has allowed these facts to be hijacked as a defense of intelligent design. In other words, there must be some kind of God that created this, because it can't be that much of a coincidence. Yeah. So, and scientists are calling this the Goldilocks principle, meaning that the cosmos or the universe is not too much this or too much that, but just right for life to exist. That's in the story of Goldilocks. It's not that that gravity is a little too strong or gravity is a little too weak. It's just right. It's the Goldilocks principle for life to exist on Earth. So various theories like intelligent design and just that it's an amazing coincidence, scientists are struggling with. Why is it so, this universe so perfect for life? But this author says, well, biocentrism solves this dilemma immediately. Because, as he says, without perception, there is, in effect, no reality. Nothing has any existence unless you, I, or some living creature perceives it. And how it is perceived further influences that reality. Even time itself is not exempted from biocentrism. So time, in other words, is not some like physical quality in the universe that rolls along at a certain speed without sentient beings. That actually time is a perception of life. And space, these are kind of the building blocks of what we call the world and the universe, are time and space. But both of them, he proposes, we can see are actually kind of projections of sentient life. So he says, biocentrism explains how the universe is created by life. Biocentrism. Obviously, no universe that doesn't allow for life could possibly exist, according to biocentrism. The universe and its parameters simply reflect the spatio-temporal logic of animal existence. So that's why it doesn't have to be such an incredible coincidence that these conditions formed for life to emerge. It's more that first there was life or consciousness, something alive, that then manifests the appearance of a universe, which is, of course, very much in harmony with that life, that mind. Does that make sense? So this is just like a really unusual idea in the scientific world. It's like taking a backward step from examining all the stuff out there and trying to explain it. It's looking back and saying, well, how is all this actually happening? So he's a somewhat controversial figure in the scientific world, and as I mentioned, you know, very well-known scientist. So some people really support his idea as a possibility, and some maybe more mainstream science is that's just going too far. Even though quantum physics is lining up more and more with this kind of view. So could say, what's all this have to do with Buddha Dharma? these teachings of biocentrism seem very similar to a lot of the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors, Zen ancestors. Maybe different purposes scientists are trying to explain the universe out of basic curiosity. And I think as Zen practitioners, we might also try trying to understand our life and the world out of basic curiosity. I think it's a virtuous quality to have, is curiosity keeps us practicing, keeps us questioning, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And particularly like in terms of our personal experience, well, why do I keep making the same mistakes? Why do I keep struggling in this life? So we can become curious about that, and we can try to work it out on the surface, try to be a better person, and so on, which are, of course, good things, just like the science that's working in the external world of discovering different elements and so on is learning more and more about how things are. But we can also, as practitioners, take this backward step and question the whole paradigm. So maybe as a kind of guided meditation, we can explore how we're experiencing the world right now. Some of these ideas may be kind of familiar and to you, but one kind of, maybe we could say, gradual approach to this immediate, ever-present realization I've recently been working with, this kind of four-step process of opening to biocentric view, or a deeper understanding of what experience actually is. Something we can just say, well, just turn the light around and ask, what is this? That's the kind of just one-step sudden approach. But I find this four-step approach kind of helpful, and I've talked with some people about it, and they say, oh, I can really like follow this way of looking with these kind of steps. So see if you can follow this. I'll try to go slow, or stop me if it doesn't make sense. I would call these four perspectives on the experience we're having right now. Not exactly like shifting perception, we might call it that, but let's just say four different perspectives. We can look at our experience we're having right now in these four ways. The first would be just our usual way of experiencing. I think, it seems to me, for myself anyway, this is the usual way of experiencing life, is that I feel as if, this is a kind of unexamined experience, I feel as if I, Kokyo, am a body and mind experiencing the world. Can you relate to that? Doesn't it seem like kind of the usual way? And we even hear Buddhist teachings about this. We can even take out like some, you know, fixed identity of self called me, and say body and mind. Say five skandhas is Buddhist technical language for body and mind. It seems like I feel as if I am a body and mind. We could expand that into mind, into feelings and intentions and so on. But body and mind experiencing a world. And it's this basic dualistic experience. There's me, body and mind, and a world over there is the object. Body and mind is the subject. The world is the object. I think that's our usual experience. And if we start to like check out how that experience is, I find it feels kind of like limited and constricted and not totally satisfying. It's basically this division between me and the world seems almost like inherently painful, at least a little bit. Even a wonderful, pleasant experience seems to be somewhat tainted by this dualistic split. And this is what the Buddhas teach too. So even though it seems to work pretty well to negotiate the world, body and mind relating to the world, in a kind of functional way, it has a lot of problems. When the world doesn't go the way I, the body and mind, want it to, I'm not so happy. And the body and mind, the world sometimes seems to be against me, the body and mind. So these are some of the problems, right? So now, we can start examining our experience more closely now. That's like without any examination, our usual way. We can start looking. What is this experience? How exactly are we experiencing it? What does it mean to be a body and mind experiencing the world? Or we can even ask, well, who really is this body and mind experiencing the world? And we start to see, we can start to shift the perspective now, or try out a different perspective of, what if it's more like there's consciousness, aware of the world, but also that body and mind are also kind of like objects of consciousness. So instead of the body and mind being the subject and the world being the object, we can look at the body as sensations, basically. When we start examining what is the body in our experience, it seems to be physical sensations and maybe visual appearances if we look at the body. But that's how we know the body in experience. Like, there's not so much, like, or if there's like a flesh and blood kind of body, we don't experience that except as tactile sensations and colors and sounds and sensations, mostly physical sensations is how we know the body. So now we have consciousness, you could say part of mind is now the subject and body is now the object of that consciousness. And mind, including like feelings, thoughts, and emotions, are also not so much me, the subject, that's this mix of body, thoughts, feelings, and emotions experiencing the world, but both the body, which is sensations, the mind, which is thoughts, emotions, and images, and the world, which actually if we look at what our experience of the world is, it's like perceptions of color and sound and smell and taste and so on. So now we have consciousness as the subject aware of the body, which is sensations, the mind, which is images, thoughts, and feelings, and the world, which is perceptions, which are now objects of consciousness. Could you follow that shift? Mm-hmm. And not just the idea of it, but can you actually feel the different perspective? My actual experience is now I am a consciousness experiencing body, mind, and world as objects. Still, it's dualistic, right? There's a subject and an object, but we've shifted a bunch of what the subject is into the object realm. Kind of strange. It just shows how our perception and perspective on the world is quite malleable. We can consciously make a shift like this, and now we can even check out how that is. It personally, for me, it feels like there's a little less constriction. It feels things seem a little bit more open. Like, for example, the body, I might feel is like, if it's this flesh and blood chunky thing, I gotta like feed it and protect it and maintain it, and it's maybe like, and I can be kind of scared of it, even scared of this body as this thing. But now if the body is more just received as sensations, it's more, there's more curiosity about it. What? This is how I know this body is sensations. Of course I can still take care of the sensations by creating less painful ones, for example. But it's almost more relaxing, I find, this shift, that little shift of perspective. The body seems less like this solid object and more like workable somehow. But still, this is this duality. The consciousness is perceiving mind, body, and world. Or body, mind, and world, again, as sensations, thoughts, and feelings, and the world is perceptions. And I say consciousness because in Buddhism, usually we use the word consciousness to mean like this divided, dualistic kind of knowing of things. So now we can just keep examining our experience even more deeply. What is this consciousness that's knowing the body, mind, and world? It seems like a kind of a witness, right? Now we're kind of a witnessing consciousness. And I think also this shift of perspective opens us to the kind of primacy of this witnessing consciousness, that it's almost like it's the, like when we're looking at our experience, we see that it's actually the main thing, right, in our experience. And it's what all the experiences are happening to, actually, right? And we can start examining now this consciousness. Consciousness is usually dependent, in Buddhist teachings, dependent on the objects and so on. But we can start to look at that. Is this consciousness a limited, dualistic knower? We can start to ask questions like, can we find any edges or boundaries to this consciousness? And in our direct experience at this moment, it seems like we might have ideas that it has an edge, that it, or that it meets, it goes out and meets the object. But are these actually just ideas that we've been told, even by Buddhist sutras, that consciousness meets objects? There are in the early teachings of foundational Buddhist teachings like this. So do they shape our direct experience? Or is it more that we can't actually feel or see or find a place where the consciousness meets the object? Just try in our experience to look for that place. Even with the sensation of the body, there's a consciousness seems to be meeting the body right here at the point of contact. But can we find, from the point of view of conscious awareness here, can we find that point of contact in space? We seem to when we line it up with our eyes, but the more we look into it, the less findable is the meeting place between the consciousness and the objects. Can you follow that? Does it seem that way to you? Hopefully this is not like a stretch. I wouldn't want to talk anyone into something outside their experience. But it seems like we usually don't examine our own experience this closely, right? We're so used to certain perspectives. So if we can't find any edges or boundaries, you can try this at home too and look for that. And see if you can find. If we can't, then now the perspective can shift, almost naturally does shift, just by looking very deeply into the experience. It shifts into the limited dualistic consciousness, shifts into awareness, a more boundless edgeless, centerless awareness, just by looking for it and not finding a limited one. What is revealed is the boundless nature of awareness, it seems to me. It's still aware, and it still seems like we're so used to seeing the objects outside it, but now if it's boundless and has no edges and doesn't actually meet the objects, if we take that to heart in our actual experience, then what are these objects that we were calling the body, the mind, and the world, or the sensations, the thoughts and feelings, and the perceptions that we call the world? They seem to be more like they're happening in the kind of sphere, the boundless sphere of awareness. It seems that way in my experience. That might be, you know, a story that we can that we're overlaying here, but see how it actually feels to you. I can kind of open to it as I can't find the object as separate from, but they're more like happening in, like awareness is like an ocean or space, and the body and the mind and the world, in other words, sensations, thoughts, feelings, and perceptions are like somehow in this space. It's an unusual perspective, but it's actually, it seems to be happening right now. If we just look at it in that way, if we can see it in that way. So this is this third perspective now, right? The first was this, I am the body and the mind, aware of a world. The second is, I am this consciousness, dualistic consciousness, aware of the body and the mind. And now it's more like, I'm not a dualistic consciousness, but more like an edgeless, boundless awareness that doesn't meet objects, but actually includes these experiences of body, mind, and world within myself as the awareness. But that's still a little bit dualistic, you might say. Really? No, that isn't that non-duality? Seems to me it's a little dualistic. If the experiences are happening in this space, like the furniture is in the room, we don't say the furniture is the room, right? There's a little bit of duality there, is there not? To have something happening in something else. We're actually, I think what we're doing in this perspective shift is we're breaking down our hard and fast dualistic structure that's actually illusory. But we're still, it's a gradual process. We can approach it in this gradual way. Now it's almost non-dual, we could say, but if the experiences of body, mind, and world are happening in the awareness, they're a little bit other than it. So we can look a little deeper. This is, you know, quite subtle if you haven't looked at experience in this way. Maybe it's a little hard to stay with it. We have to stay kind of focused and quiet and present while doing this. But looking a little bit deeper, we can say, well, how is it really that these experiences are happening in the awareness? Or is there no separation at all? Is it more that the body, meaning sensations, and the mind, meaning thoughts, feelings, emotions, and the world, meaning perceptions of color and sound, is it more that they are this boundless space of awareness? Almost as if the boundless, indivisible space of awareness is kind of manifesting as body, mind, and world. Or it's expressing itself as body, mind, and world. It's taking the shape. The shapeless awareness is taking the shape of body, mind, and world. That's what we call experience. That's what we, a sentient being, we could say is this boundless, objectless, subjectless, awareness, it's not so much, if we think of it as a subject, then that means it has an object. It's not a subject or an object. It's boundless, centerless, edgeless, beginningless, endless, and yet there's all this experience happening. Could it be that this experience is actually the nadir of this awareness? I don't usually think this way, but I can open to that perspective. And if now body, mind, and world are actually made of awareness, they still feel the same, right? Our usual old body, our usual old mind and thoughts and emotions and our usual perception of this world of things is actually, seems like this fourth perspective. We can start to sense how it's actually made of the awareness. Can you follow that? That's a little tricky. And the difference between the third and the fourth, experientially. I hope that these aren't just like ideas. You have to like actually like try them on. At the risk of like, well, maybe we're talking ourselves into, or Kokyo's talking me into some weird state of mind. But actually, let's keep examining our most direct experience of whatever's happening every moment. These divisions, we can't actually find them. And therefore, if now we see that the body, mind, and world are the awareness, there's not the slightest trace of separation between them or difference between them, then we have like non-duality, or at least a verbal explanation of it in clunky words. And but I would propose this is one way to hear these teachings like the Heart Sutra. In emptiness, we can call this boundless awareness. Emptiness, there is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue other than the awareness, right? It's not that there's nothing, everything stops existing and it goes blank. That would be crazy. Or death or something, right? There's eye, ear, nose, tongue, body made of emptiness. And it seems like we can actually like open to that perspective and just ordinarily sitting here talking, not even in some deep zazen. And in that perspective, it's less, now things are really kind of ungraspable, right? We're still a talking person, a listening person in this room, but it's really not that way. How is all this happening? It's just like miraculous. It seems more and more miraculous and inconceivable that how awareness, empty awareness, could be taking the shape of body, mind, and world. And I think that's kind of what Robert Lowndes is proposing. Maybe actually possible. And just so it doesn't seem like this is crazy talk, that I'm just making this up, that this shift from body and mind as the subject, or we could say I as the body and mind, I as the witness, I as experiencing appearances in awareness, and I as the awareness experiencing appearances as awareness. Or there's, you know, appearances as objects, then there's appearances in awareness, and then there's appearances as awareness. They actually are made of awareness. So one of the old Chinese Zen teachers, Chang Sha, said, "The entire world of the ten directions is the single eye of a practitioner." Could that be talking about biocentrism? The entire world of the 10 directions is the whole body of a practitioner. I mean, we can hear these things as just mystical statements, but if from this perspective, can we actually hear it almost as an ordinary experience we could actually have right now? It's just a different perspective. The entire world in the 10 directions means like the whole universe is the whole body of a practitioner. The entire world of the 10 directions is the radiant light of the self. The entire world of the 10 directions is within the radiant light of the self. In the entire world of the 10 directions, there is no single person that is not the self. That's Changsha from the 9th century. The radiant light of awareness, we can also call the self. These Zen people weren't afraid of calling it a self. Even the Mahayana sutras, I won't get into it now, but there's various Mahayana sutras that say, where the Buddha's disciples come and say, Buddha, I thought you taught that there's no self. And the Buddha says, that was just an expedient teaching in the foundational vehicle. There is a self called Buddha nature, but it's not some graspable thing. Linji, a little bit more poetically, Zen teacher Linji in the 9th century said, followers of the way, this lone brightness before my eyes right now, this person plainly listening to me, I think talking to the audience, calling the assembly a lone brightness, this one single brightness before my eyes right now, this person plainly listening to me, this person is unimpeded at any point, but penetrates the 10 directions, free to do as she pleases in the entire world. No matter what the environment she may encounter, with its peculiarities and differences, she cannot be swayed or pulled awry. That's Linji, or Rinzai. And then Dogen, in Japan, our Soto ancestor says, what Buddhas call the self is the entire earth. He's probably influenced by Changsha. What the Buddhas call the self is the entire earth. Thus, there is never an entire universe that is not the self, with or without our knowing it. So you could say, we are actually just one reality called the universe, or called awareness, or called the self, or called knowing, or called experience, or called Buddha nature, or called just this, or called the ungraspable mystery. But there's nothing else. Thus, there is never an entire universe that is not the self, with or without our knowing it. So we might be in this first perspective, like I usually am. I'm a body and mind, and there's the world. So I don't know it. But this actually, myself is the universe at that time. It's true, but I'm in a different perspective. And Dogen says, an ancient Buddha said, the mountains, rivers, and earth are born at the same moment with each person. All Buddhas of the past, present, and future are practicing together with each person. So the world is born with us, the mountains, rivers, and earth world, with each person. And all Buddhas throughout space and time are practicing with us, because there's no time and space apart from just our human constructions. So, what do you say? Could you follow these four perspectives? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Do you think it's brainwashing? Of the of the biocentrists and the Buddhas and ancestors and me.
It's bio-connected.
Bio-connected, yeah. And I appreciate Robert Lanza says, some scientists in his scientific community who haven't really maybe intimately checked out their own experience, but just go with the idea, say, that sounds like solipsism, which means like you're the only consciousness in the universe. And they say, well, when Robert Lanza dies, I hope we die before him, or else we're not going to have a universe to live in, because it's his universe. And he says, they don't get it. It's not solipsism. It's almost like, I think he said, it's like almost group solipsism, in the sense that it's a together thing. It's no one consciousness here. It's one mind that's manifesting as a bunch of different bodies and consciousnesses and worlds that kind of overlap in this amazingly intricate way. Yes, Nettie.
I've been kind of trying out this sort of idea, and what I've been noticing is it doesn't feel self-centered. I start feeling like the chair's got the awareness, or the zazen has the awareness. It does feel very expansive and collaborative and friendly.
Hopefully that's the case, yes, exactly. Total collaboration with the grass, walls, tiles, and pebbles, actually, and totally friendly, even when people seem to be even harming us. It's like, well, they're us, actually. So it's the realm of total intimacy. I think another name for it also is love. This realm, this fourth perspective, I think we could call it love. We don't usually use that word in Buddhism so much, but I understand like true, unconditional love can't really have an object. It's like if I love ice cream or I love a person that seems to be outside me, it's quite limited and quite conditional. You could say even if I love them no matter what they do, but or when they die, then they're gone, right? But truly unconditional love seems to be like there can't be an other. There can't be self and other. And that's this realm where the so-called other is made of awareness, and the so-called this body is the so-called other to that person is also made of awareness. So it's there's literally no separation. Yeah. Literally no separation. I mean, how much more intimate could one experience this life that is intimacy? Everything else could be like somewhat intimate. Like the second and third perspectives are pretty good. They're shifting our usual perspective. I think they're more intimate with the one mind of reality. But and then we can and hopefully the purpose of all this is clear, that if it's love that we're talking about here, then it's not just some funny mind exercise, right? It's like how we can meet our life, how we can meet our body, our mind, and feelings, and thoughts, and images, and meet the world. And still, you know, take care of it even the most lovingly and respectfully, you know. Yes.
I'm often aware of my mother, who really cared so deeply for me and wrote songs, which I still hear in my head. And then every time I put my wakasu on, I remember Blanche, who is my sewing teacher, and how much love she has for me and for everyone. And I really sense quite clearly they're right here with me all the time.
Yeah.
Among many others. Mm-hmm.
And not, you could say, in various ways, they, the images of them, mm-hmm. In the form of memories, mm-hmm. we could say as mind, is completely intimate with this awareness. So in that way, kind of conventional way, yeah. we remember them. And in this deeper way, yeah. too, they are made out of this awareness. Mm-hmm. So
it's loving awareness. It isn't just awareness. In both cases, and in many more.
It is loving in the most deepest way. It's not maybe even our usual, it's not limited by even our idea of love.
Yeah.
It is love.
Yeah.
Maybe not even a loving awareness. It actually... Because it doesn't do the act of loving.
Yes.
It, like, actually is love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And all beings are that love. And we meet them. And that we can meet the ancient Buddhas, too, that are long gone. Because, as Dogen says, the Buddhas of past, present, and future are all always practicing with us. Mm-hmm. And they're born with us. As the mountains, rivers, and earth are born with us moment to moment.
And just hearing their words, that brings it alive to us now.
Yeah, that's part of how we meet. Even though you could say we're always already met. In fact, there's not really, in this realm, in this perspective, actually there's no meeting anymore. Because meeting involves somebody meeting something else. It involves a coming together from a separation. This is the realm where there's never been any separation, so that therefore we can't meet anymore. Mm-hmm. Oh well.
We can just be.
In this realm of love, we can't meet where we just can be.
Yeah.
Exactly. We just are. Yeah.
We are in love.
We can't meet and we can't separate.
Yeah.
We are in it. We are it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, form and emptiness are not the slightest trace separate, right? In the Mahayana, there's teachings like samsara itself is completely nirvana, and nirvana is completely samsara. From this perspective, that's not such a crazy statement anymore, right?
Yeah.
This is totally free, this realm, and yet it's manifesting itself as this totally painful appearances of the world of fighting and craziness. So, but from this perspective, all this fighting is actually love. And we might say, wait a second, this is going too far. But if everyone could open to how the fighting actually is love, that would be the end of the fighting, right? It doesn't excuse the fighting, but if we can see it as love, I think it's a totally confused love. It's a weird world these days, huh? I mean, the whole political situation is the awareness is manifesting in really wacky ways. So, let's remember what's going on here. Keep staying intimate with our own experience. What's really going on here? We dedicate the merit of our gathering tonight to the complete opening of all beings to the boundless non-differentiation of biocentrism. May all benefit. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.